As the number of COVID cases in U.S. immigration jails continues to rise, countries around the world are wary of taking in sick deportees.
The Trump administration knows that it has all the leverage in these conversations.
I'm Shamitha Basu, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, for Monday, May 18th, a look at how the U.S. is deporting sick migrants to countries with limited resources. Then, have you been getting any sleep lately? Yeah, us neither. How our sleep is affected by stress from the pandemic.
This sense of space, isolation, and new uncertainties, this anxiety can disrupt your sleep at night.
Also, a look at the way Sweden has been handling the pandemic, and then how family members are worried for their loved ones who are risking their health as essential workers.
I live with an essential worker. He's a fireman, and he and I have not seen each other in 9 weeks.
Let's get to it. During the coronavirus pandemic, the Trump administration has effectively closed off U.S. borders to immigrants seeking asylum. According to the Washington Post, since March 21st, just 2 asylum seekers have been allowed to stay in the U.S. by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Now, last week, the New York Times reported that the strict immigration measures are likely to be extended indefinitely until the director of the CDC, Dr. Robert Redfield, determines the virus no longer poses a threat to the U.S. But even as immigration into the country has virtually ground to a halt, the Trump administration has continued to deport large numbers of immigrants in their custody, many with COVID-19. Roughly 18,000 people were deported in March, and almost 3,000 were deported in the first 11 days of April, according to The New Yorker.
There's a lot of sick people here. Fever, coughs, body aches. They're not giving us much to wash our hands.
That's Daniel, a man detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement at one of their detention centers in the rural South. He called us a few weeks back from inside the immigration jail to describe conditions there.
A Guatemalan man fainted in here twice. The medics brought him back, then he fainted for a third time, and the medics took him again, but we don't know where.
In these facilities, where social distancing is practically impossible, there are nearly 1,000 confirmed cases out of around 2,000 tests administered by the agency as of May 15th. But those numbers could be much higher. And this high rate of infections in ICE detention centers means that some of the people being deported are bringing the virus to other countries and putting a strain on healthcare systems that are already struggling. Jacqueline Charles is a Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. She's been reporting on what these deportations have meant in Haiti. Jacqueline, thank you for coming back on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me back.
And Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His reporting has focused on recent deportations to Guatemala. Jonathan, again, thank you for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan, what do we know about the rate of positive COVID-19 cases among deportees to Guatemala?
We know very little at this point because the U.S. government hasn't been forthright in testing people who are in ICE custody. At this point, though, we know that about 106 people who have been deported from the U.S. to Guatemala have tested positive for the virus. The U.S. government has given assurances to the Guatemalan government that it will not deport anyone without giving prior health screening to the person, without generating actual documents confirming that the person is COVID-free. And yet, with every new deportation flight that touches down in Guatemala City, there seem to be new cases of people testing positive for the virus.
And how well equipped is Guatemala to deal with this influx of coronavirus positive patients?
I think the country's leaders are quite concerned, and justifiably so, in terms of their ability to respond to a virulent pandemic like this one. I mean, there are 2 major urban hospitals in the entire country. This is a country of some 18 million people. There are a patchwork of regional medical facilities and now 4 temporary hospitals that have been erected on the fly. But I think it's fair to say that the country is really in a tight spot and has legitimate cause for concern here.
Jacqueline, your reporting focuses on Haiti. How many known positive cases have been detected among people being deported back to Haiti?
Right now, we know of three. The deportations to Haiti only recently got started. And after the second deportation flight, those individuals were tested. One of them broke out of quarantine after he was told of his status. At the same time, what I've been told by advocates on the ground is that while there's security where they are quarantined by the government for 14 days after they arrive, well, at night after 9 o'clock, the security guard leaves. And so individuals basically go out and they mingle with the regular population. So that raises also a lot of questions in terms of people and their status and the ability to spread disinfection. We are now into our third deportation, and I am told that another one will come soon. So what we're seeing, the pattern is every 2 weeks, there's a deportation flight to Haiti.
I see. And that third deportation you're talking about, is that the one that you reported on? It was an ICE deportation flight that was supposed to be carrying 55 detainees, including five people who had tested positive for COVID-19 last week. And we reached out to ICE and they told us that those five people were ultimately not on board that flight, the five who had tested positive. So does that mean that they're remaining in ICE custody indefinitely, or what happens to them?
The initial flight manifest had 101 individuals on it, including a death squad leader that they removed after that was exposed. Then the flight that arrived had 50 people, but the Haitians were expecting 100. And we were in touch with some of the detainees as well as their family members, and we were sort of tracking what was happening. And ICE was assuring the Haitian government that no one who had tested positive 72 hours, well, that they were going to perform tests 72 hours in advance, and that no one who tested positive would be deported. But through our, you know, inquiries and keeping in touch with family members, we were realizing that some of the ones we knew who had tested positive had not been retested within that 72-hour window. And so, yes, ultimately, in the end, those five individuals were not sent back to Haiti. They remain in ICE custody, and we're looking to see if they will be sent back to Haiti on the next flight. We've been asking, you know, of the 100 people who were originally supposed to fly down, how many were tested, and why were only 50 people sent and not 50 others? And we have not been able to get an answer from ICE.
And we also reached out to ICE for comment, and listeners can read the entire statement that they sent us on our website. But ICE said that they expect each country to continue accepting deportees despite the circumstances. Now, Jonathan, I understand the Guatemalan government has attempted to halt deportation flights leaving the U.S. How is the Trump administration responding to these requests?
The Trump administration knows that it has all the leverage in these conversations, particularly with Central American governments like Guatemala, which are pretty dependent on all sorts of things from the U.S. But also the sort of main threat that the United States wields in these conversations is to threaten to withdraw all visas for travelers from those countries, which tends to affect the kind of upper set and most influential and powerful members of, in this case, Guatemalan society. And so that is really the major sort of cudgel with which the U.S. kind of beats the Guatemalans into accepting the continuation of these flights, even though everyone is uncomfortable about what that means.
But the Trump administration did make some adjustments to its policies for deportations to Guatemala specifically, right? Is it clear how effective those changes are going to be?
In theory, the U.S. government did make a few concessions, but no one I spoke to, either on the Guatemalan side or on the American side, were convinced that those concessions meant that much in any practical way. So, for example, the U.S. government said, okay, rather than sending 100 people on every deportation flight from the U.S., we'll lower that number to 75, which was meant to lower the risk, I suppose, of people infecting each other on these planes. And then they also promised to generate paperwork confirming that those who were arriving in Guatemala City had been tested for COVID-19 and that those tests were negative. But immediately after those agreements were made between the U.S. and Guatemalan authorities, Guatemalan health minister tested new arrivals and found immediately that among those who had just arrived in Guatemala City, who had apparently gone through this whole new battery of tests pursuant to the agreement, they were still testing positive. So I don't think anyone has any illusions about the bad faith in which both the White House is acting and ICE as an agency is acting right now.
Jacqueline, I understand in Haiti there was a presidential panel assembled of medical experts, right, to provide guidance. And that panel is calling for the suspension of these deportation flights from the U.S. Is that position being echoed by anyone else? Is it being received by Haiti's government?
Well, you know, Haiti's government initially did raise concerns with the U.S. when they wanted them to start to accept deportations. And those concerns were ignored. The foreign minister raised them. And at some point, somebody higher up than him, basically the president, decided to accept these deportations. But it's similar to what's happening in Guatemala, is that countries like Haiti, they have no leverage in these conversations because they need the U.S. support in whichever form that it comes. But there is concern. I mean, this presidential panel made up of physicians point out to the fact that when you look at the rate of the infections here in the United States, and you look at Haiti and how vulnerable it is, that this poses a huge threat. One of the deportees, not among the five, but another one that we initially wrote about, he tested positive after they did not send him to ICE because he had been exposed. Mm-hmm. So after not sending him to Haiti, he tested positive. And then we just learned out a few days ago that he was put back into the general population without another test. I think one of the problems in terms of Haiti, Jamaica, these other countries, is that they test twice. And they don't understand in the United States, one, it's difficult to get tested. And then if somebody tests positive, there's no guarantee that they will be tested a second time or third time to ensure that they are negative. So right now, you know, the advocates, immigration advocates, activists in the United States, they shared this position of the scientific panel in Haiti, but we have not heard anything from either the president or the prime minister in terms of them pursuing or even doing what Guatemala's president did publicly, which was ask for these flights to be halted or for measures to be stepped up.
Jonathan, I'm wondering if there's any precedence for this. I mean, during public health emergencies in the past, how has the U.S. typically dealt with immigrant detention and deportations? And what kind of rationale is the current administration giving for not halting deportations right now?
In the past, there have been flare-ups in ICE custody of small portions of the population. And the mentality has always been to try to isolate that population in custody. But nothing at all approaching the scale of what we're seeing now. The rationale the Trump administration gives is, I think it's fair to say, plainly disingenuous. The rationale is that for as long as this pandemic exists, the president has to act in the best interest of the public health of American citizens. But the idea of deporting people who are known to have been either exposed to the virus or to have actually tested positive for the virus, and to deport them to new places, thereby spreading the virus, particularly in places where the medical care infrastructure is limited, actually, I don't think serves the general cause of public health at all. Mm-hmm. And if the administration really were concerned about the public health implications of this virus for those in detention, there are all kinds of things that ICE could do more systematically to help treat and care for those in its custody. There are 30,000 people across the country in ICE detention right now. There are 5,000 people in ICE custody who came to the U.S. seeking asylum, who passed their what's called credible fear interview, their first screening, and who nonetheless remain in detention. That's not anything that's happened before. That is a feature of the Trump administration trying to detain asylum seekers indefinitely. Now, to kind of top it all off, they're deporting those who have been exposed to this sort of petri dish in ICE detention to new countries and having these other countries deal with the problem.
Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and Jacqueline Charles is a Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
During the pandemic, anxieties run high during the day. People are worried about their families, their jobs, not to mention how long we're going to have to stay home. And at least for me, I know I've noticed that this has been affecting my sleep. And I know that I'm not the only one.
This sense of space, isolation, and new uncertainties make people more anxious. Mm-hmm. This anxiety can disrupt your sleep at night.
That's Dr. Alcibiades J. Rodriguez, medical director of New York University's Langone Sleep Disorder Center. We turn to him to try to understand if people really are having more trouble sleeping right now, and why. And he told us that there are several factors leading to our irregular sleep.
Everybody has a circadian rhythm in the sleep-wake cycle. And what leads that, the main marker of that, is the sunlight. But besides that, it's our social interaction, the time we do exercise, the time we eat, and the time we socialize. Circadian rhythm may be affected because many people are working at home for the first time. And not only that, you may be used to work at home, but usually you are alone. Your spouse, your partner, they may not be there, and your children are not there all the time. So that also may disrupt your circadian rhythm. So the moment many people are sleeping at different times, they're staying late, they don't need to commute, they're sleeping later, they may take a nap they usually don't do. So that by itself can change your sleep-wake habits. On top of that, the amount of anxiety can cause problems with difficulties to fall asleep. We know that insomnia is very closely related to mood disorder, including anxiety. On top of that, is the sense for some people, alone or not, of isolation. You need some social interaction. You need some marking at work. I hear some people that they want to go to work, not only because of the economical situation, because that helps for you.
They miss being at work. They miss the social aspect, you're saying, right?
Yes, that can, especially you are alone. That can make you depressed. And you are depressed, you know, depression. People may start sleeping more, or they may start not sleeping.
And what about the psychology of being in your home all the time? I understand what you're saying about routines being disrupted, certainly, but from a psychological aspect, being in the same setting throughout your day, for those who are staying at home right now, what kind of impact is that having on sleep?
I think some people sleep in studios, small places. Now work is in the bedroom. We advise usually people that bed is only to sleep. They are not that far from the kitchen. They snack at different times. So this sense of space, isolation, and new uncertainties make people more anxious, can cause more awakenings at night, can cause that, for example, you wake up in the middle of the night and you start watching the news to see what's new.
Right.
And you go to bed watching the news at night and you get more stressed. So this sense of isolation, no interaction, that causes stress by itself too.
So what are some of the health consequences we're seeing, or that we could see down the line, as a result of poor sleep right now?
Yeah, we know that sleep deprivation, one way or the other, has significant implications. The first one, of course, the one that you feel the next day, is feeling tired, fatigue, lack of energy. I'm sure you are being sleep deprived at some point. You feel like a fog. You feel like you are in slow motion. If you have a headache, it's going to feel 10 times worse. If you have back pain, it's going to feel 20 times worse. So the concentration, attention, the speed of answering question or doing certain tasks is going to decrease. And that's the immediate consequence. In the long term, sleep deprivation may affect your memory. And there's some evidence studying lymphocyte cytokine response that sleep deprivation actually may decrease your response to infection, affect your immune system.
Yeah, so what can people be doing to try and sleep better?
Well, my first advice is try to bring some normalcy in these abnormal times. There are some things that you cannot control. You cannot control the virus. You cannot control the regulation that now close the restaurant so you don't have a job. Things that you can control is your sleep-wake cycle. Try to keep the regular schedule. Mm-hmm. Go to bed usually at 10, wake up at 5:30. I do my exercise. Try to take some light through the window or walk a little bit out before it gets too crowded and get some sun exposure. Sun exposure gives you some degree of regular sleep-wake cycle. Mm. Once you get this first sun exposure during the day, you're supposed to go to sleep 16, 18 hours later. So that's very important. Try to get your meals at the time you usually get your meals. Don't take naps. Don't try to, if you didn't sleep well last night, don't try to compensate taking naps, because the next day you're going to also disrupt your sleep. And after 1 or 2 weeks, your sleep is going to be totally fragmented. Decrease the amount of alcohol, especially at bedtime, because alcohol fragments your sleep. Mm. I tell people to don't watch the news 24/7. Mm. Just watch a couple of times during the day. Don't watch it too late after 7, 8 p.m. because you're going to go with that to bed. Try to get a book, read something not really related to what is happening. Try to distract your mind a little bit. Socialize if you can with your family. And if you have problems, please reach to your doctor. Just recognize it. Sleep physician, we are seeing patients and we can help.
I hope this isn't too personal, doctor, but how have you been sleeping lately?
I'm been sleeping well. I try to keep my normalcy, but I have my days, no? My mother lives in Panama, so at the beginning, I was thinking how long it's going to take until I see her again. And I start to dream a little bit about that and maybe wake up for more than I should be in the middle of the night. So I try to keep my routine, wake up at the same time. I do my exercise, take my meals at the same time. We work. It's not we're not working, so we're doing some telemedicine. And then you try to watch some of the sport that is still available, but I think the German League starts tomorrow. So that's the way I'm trying to cope. Yes, we can, but I can tell you, sometimes I've been guilty and sometimes you fall asleep in the middle of the afternoon.
Yeah, that's understandable. It sounds like you're also saying to be a little forgiving with yourself too.
Yes.
Dr. Alcibiades J. Rodriguez, Medical Director of New York University's Langone Sleep Disorder Center. Alcibiades told me that there's a reason some people who have the coronavirus are reporting more vivid dreams.
You are sick. Fever goes up, you shiver, and you during REM sleep is when we dream. 95% of the dreams, the vivid ones, occur in REM sleep. During REM sleep, human beings, we lose the ability of control your temperature. So the temperature gets more unstable. And so on top of that, you have a high fever, you may have frequent micro arousals and have the tendency to remember your dreams more.
But for those of us who have not had COVID-19, but are also noticing changes in our dreams, there's an explanation for that too.
We know that dreams usually are very closely related to anxiety. And the most studies that have been done has been done with post-traumatic stress disorder, acute and chronic. So if somebody has a major traumatic event in their life, you may have the tendency to dream about it or to have some relationship. Now, the dreams that we remember by default are usually the more significant ones. If you have a bad dream that you call nightmares, by definition, you need to remember them. We, all of us, we dream every night, and it's normal not to remember our dreams. But if you are in REM sleep and somebody keeps waking you up, touching you a little bit, or making a little noise, you will have the tendency to remember more of the dreams. So I think in this element of anxiety, where the sleep fragmentation, people may start to remember the dreams more, and usually related to activities or things that worries you during the day.
We also wanted to hear from you on this. We asked you how COVID-19 has affected your sleep and your dreams.
This is Terry Mintz calling from Bend, Oregon. Last week, I had a dream that the pandemic ended and everyone got to take off their masks. But when some of the people took off their masks, they didn't have facial features except for eyes anymore. And at first, people without facial features were feared, but ultimately, they were revered as people who took the pandemic really seriously and wore their masks diligently and made the ultimate sacrifice and lost their faces.
My name is David. I'm calling from La Habra, California. And lately, my dreams have been very detailed and very intense. So much that some nights I can't go back to sleep. The creepiest so far was of me suddenly laying in bed with death at the end of my bed. And he whispered, "Wake up."
Rick Wilson, Fairland, Oklahoma. My daughter and I talked about the question, and we both agreed that our dreams are more social. We have more people in our dreams, and that's something that seems to have changed for us.
This is Jean calling from Seattle, Washington. Dreams have been incredibly vivid during this pandemic time. A recent one I had, I was hanging from a bar from a small airplane, fighting zombies by hitting them with a bowling pin.
This is Ryan from Berwick, Maine. I just woke up at 12:30 p.m., which has been pretty consistent. I distinctly remember I was dreaming about a swanky 1920s resort with Louis Armstrong and other famous people from that era. "I got you," he said, and he took my hand and led me around to meet all of his friends. Everyone was so excited to meet me. They thought I was so funny and so cool.
Up in the morning, out on the job, work like the devil for my pay.
Thanks so much for sharing your dreams with us. You can keep telling us about your sleep during the pandemic at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Heaven all day.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Shamitha Basu. Essential workers, from delivery drivers to nurses to grocery store clerks to audio board operators and so many more, have been keeping us all going for the last 2 months. We've talked on this show about the stress and the risks that essential workers face doing their work under these circumstances. Now, as it becomes clear that COVID-19's grip on the country is far from over, we wanted to check in on not just essential workers who are still getting out there every day, but also on their loved ones, the ones who, for weeks or months, have been supporting, fearing for, and loving frontline workers, often from afar. And we heard from so many of you.
My name is Cynthia, and I'm calling today to let everyone know that I live with an essential worker. He's a first responder. He's a fireman. And he and I have not seen each other in 9 weeks. And I'm immunosuppressed, so in order to keep me safe, he is elected not to come home. So it's rough.
I am the essential worker in the household. Everyone else is home. And it puts a strain on the relationship because I'm not only doing what I used to do. When I get home, it creates a whole different issue because of what I may have been exposed to. I'm limited to certain areas in the house. I find it difficult to take care of elderly parents. There's a lot of stress that goes with being an essential worker.
My name is Judith Brown, calling from Lakewood, New Jersey. My daughter's a paramedic. She's also expecting, and I completely understand her need to serve, but at the same time, it makes things a little stressful. Still, I'm just going to be there for her. You know, it doesn't really matter whether she stays well or not. I'm just going to be there for her.
This is Mark Urquhart, calling from Westport, Connecticut. ER nurses are special people to begin with, and we live next to a very special one of those. Josephine, who we bought a ukulele for to take her mind off of being at ER, and we bring her flowers for her pleasure.
This is Fred. I have a son who is a sheriff in one of the largest counties in the country. I am a past firefighter, and I think the answer is we just do our jobs. We rely on our faith, whatever that faith may be. Mine is a belief in Heavenly Father, and we do our jobs, and we move forward because we're supposed to. And it's just that simple.
This is Julie calling from Erie, Colorado, and my daughter is providing emergency child care for essential workers. And she's actually doing really well. She mostly just comes home very tired. She takes amazing precautions to protect herself and the rest of us in our house. And I just do my best to listen every day and greet her with a glass of wine.
These experiences you shared resonate with many of us who have loved ones working in essential jobs right now, including my colleague, Verilyn Williams.
So my dad works for FedEx. He's been mostly focused on shipping.
Verilyn is the senior producer for the WNYC Studios podcast, The United States of Anxiety. She and her family are from Sierra Leone, and she says the desire to help others has always been a part of who her dad is.
Especially when it comes to like the Sierra Leonean community, that responsibility of being helpful to the community, he's always been that person.
But now, after weeks of doing essential work on the streets of New York, and with more weeks ahead, Verilyn is thinking about what makes her dad vulnerable as he keeps going out day after day.
As Black people, whether it's health risks, whether it's, you know, the ways in which, like, being confronted by racism, whether it's our body, it's hard for me to say this out loud, but like my dad is at the intersection of all of that, right? And so it's like when you know better, you have to do better. And it's just been hard for me to accept that he's just like out here on the train every day, you know? Like I haven't been on the train since March 9th, you know, and I guess I wish that I was in a position to be able to pay his mortgage so he doesn't have to get on the train, you know? So it's been difficult. Mm-hmm. It's just been like in this world of uncertainty that we're all living in, it's just, you're almost waiting for the other shoe to drop, right? I just feel like I'm going to get a call and something, you know, something horrible is going to be at the end of that call. But I will say though, that there is the other side of things where if my dad did stay home every day, like how would that affect his mental health? Right. And so I think I'm just trying to weigh out those things. And how about you, Shamita? I know that you have family who are also essential workers.
Yeah, well, my sister-in-law, Christina, has been a nurse for many years, and she now works as a lactation specialist. So she's working with moms and new moms in a hospital here in New York. And my little cousin is a high school senior in New Jersey, and he's been accepted to NYU in the fall. He wants to go into a medical field. And for the past few months, he's been continuing his work as a volunteer EMT. And I've been so blown away by him still going out and being really dedicated to doing this work at this really difficult time and seeing a bunch of really difficult scenes too. And I think that these are the things that I'm weighing when I'm talking to people these days in the work that I'm doing. For me, at least as a reporter, when I'm not sitting in this chair and filling in for Tanzina Vega here on The Takeaway, usually I'm a reporter in the WNYC newsroom. And ever since this the stay-at-home order has been in place in New York, I've been doing my reporting from my living room and just making a lot of phone calls, which is really not the preferred way of reporting, but it's all that we've been able to do. And for me, at least, I feel like I now approach every phone call with the assumption that the person I'm calling is likely dealing with some form of trauma. They might be dealing with loss. They might be dealing with illness in their family, or they might just be dealing generally with the anxiety of having someone that they love doing essential work right now and worrying about them. I wonder if you're feeling like these conversations that you're having with your dad are informing your work that you're making right now.
You know, journalism and the spaces that I've worked have always felt very white and not necessarily speaking to my experience or speaking to people in my life or people in my community. And so I've always worked really hard to kind of center that in my work. And so, yeah, this moment is no different. It's a struggle, though, because I think a lot of the people most impacted by COVID have always been the people who have been on the margins, right? And so I think I do, because we can't go out, I do feel a lot of survivor's remorse, I guess, around the fact that I just know that, yes, I can turn the lens to my parents because I have access to them in this moment, and I could like have my dad come to my house and talk to him. But then I also think about like, well, you know, I moved to this building. Like, is there someone in this building that should not be sheltering in home with the people that are in their house, right? And I think I just, because that's the work that I've always done, not being able to do it, but still be so close to it, it feels, yeah, I try not to think about it too much because I would probably drive myself crazy a little bit.
Verilyn Williams is a senior producer for the WNYC Studios podcast, The United States of Anxiety. Verilyn, thank you so much.
Thank you, Shamita.
Most countries around the world have decided to close schools and businesses, placing strict restrictions to stop the spread of the coronavirus. But Sweden has taken a different approach. Gatherings of 50 or more people have been banned, but schools for children under 16 years old remain open, and restaurants and bars have continued serving customers. Some in the U.S. are looking to Sweden as a possible model for how to go through this pandemic while avoiding the painful consequences of the shutdown. Joining us today is Ishan Tharoor, foreign affairs columnist at The Washington Post. Hi, Ishan.
Hi there.
So can you start by explaining to us what is the so-called Swedish model for managing the outbreak?
It's tricky to brand it as a coherent, clear, and different model. What is striking, as you just pointed out, is that they did not close down schools for students under the age of 16, which is a marked difference than most other Western democracies. Certainly for us in the United States, that's been a huge part of how people have experienced lockdowns here. And rather than vigilantly enforcing lockdowns and quarantines, it's just issued certain social distancing recommendations that it trusts the Swedish public will take. What that's led to is a far more relaxed environment, or at least from the outside, it's been perceived as a far more relaxed environment in Sweden, where you see restaurants open, people congregating in groups smaller than 50. And that, for many in the US, especially American conservatives who are critical or skeptical of the degree of the lockdowns being imposed, see it as a kind of alternative.
And how does Sweden compare to other European countries, both in their approach and what we're seeing now in their outcomes?
Well, I think, you know, their approach is certainly much more relaxed. At the same time, people are social distancing on their own in many ways. Businesses have not prospered in the ways that people in the U.S. think they should without lockdowns. And of course, it's seen a very significant number of deaths, especially when compared to its Nordic neighbors. At the same time, it's lagging in testing. And Swedish officials you talk to claim that as a result of their relaxed approach, critics would say essentially a passive approach, you're seeing a situation where places like Stockholm, the capital, are approaching a level of herd immunity. Now, I'm no public health expert, and Swedish officials suggest that that's not the actual goal of the strategy. The goal of the strategy was not herd immunity, but it could be a byproduct of it. Critics of this would come back and say that essentially it's just been a very relaxed and somewhat lazy response, and Sweden as a result is suffering more than it needs to at this time of crisis.
Obviously, there are fundamental structural differences between Sweden and the United States. It becomes hard to compare these numbers and these outcomes when there are so many differences, but maybe can you walk us through some of these structural differences, particularly when it comes to healthcare and social service systems?
Right. This is what I find so fascinating about American conservatives taking up the banner of Sweden. Sweden and its neighbors have pretty robust, sophisticated welfare states. So on a health level, there is just the fundamental difference of a society that has functional universal healthcare and a society that does not. And then, of course, Sweden also has a pretty robust safety net beyond health spending, where there is effective unemployment insurance, where when this pandemic struck, the government moved to fast-track sick pay. So if you don't go to work, if you feel like you're sick and you don't want to put your colleagues at risk, you're not jeopardizing your own capacity to take care of your family. So there's just this fundamental, I would say almost cultural divide in the ways in which these societies experience these crises. And so it makes the idea that a Swedish model can be transplanted to the U.S., which is something no one in Sweden is saying, rather laughable.
Now, I also want to bring into the conversation Sweden virologist and author Lena Einhorn. Hi, Lena.
Hi.
Now, you're actually living in Stockholm right now. Tell us what life has been like in Sweden for the past few months.
Well, people my age, I'm over 60, we tend to be cautious and self-isolate to varying degrees. But the cafes are open and it's pretty dense on a sunny day in Stockholm. People are walking around and sitting in the parks and sitting in cafes and restaurants.
So does it feel like Sweden's approach is working? What does the data tell us?
The data tells us it's not working. Actually, yesterday, pulled out from our world in data are the different curves for the 9 countries in the world with the highest reported death rates. And Sweden is one of them. It's, if you exclude those microstates, Sweden is in 5th place. And what you see is that all the other countries, except for Sweden and to some extent the United States, have a bell-shaped curve. So they have very high death rates, but they have come down so that they are at very low daily death rates today, whereas Sweden is on a high plateau. And the United States is the only country which is almost as high as Sweden, but not as bad.
Lena, can you explain what herd immunity is and how it works and what's happening in Sweden?
Well, herd immunity is the concept which is usually, as it sounds, applied in veterinary contexts, uh-huh. or as a result of vaccination. It basically means that when enough people are immune against a pathogen, then the pathogen cannot really find a new host so easily. And then sort of the level of infection in society goes down. Usually this is achieved through vaccination. And the idea has been here that since we don't have a vaccine, the speculation is that the disease is often, very often, silent, so that we may actually approach herd immunity, which is requires somewhere between, depending on how contagious it is, maybe at least above 50% of society has to be immune in order to achieve this herd immunity. And so the speculation has been that because Sweden has this system whereby we have a lot of deaths and people interact more, that we would achieve this silently, this herd immunity. Mm-hmm. But in fact, when you now start getting antibody testing in various societies and also in Sweden, that's not the way it looks at all.
It seems like a very big factor in the Swedish approach to containing the outbreak has been trust in its citizens to follow guidelines. But Lena, you're saying that, you know, people are out and it's pretty dense and folks are sitting at cafes. Does it feel like this was an effective approach? And culturally, how did Swedish people respond to this?
Well, the Finnish president said, because they started out having open cafes and restaurants too, and he said very wisely, if you have a restaurant and a cafe open, people are going to go there. So you cannot keep them open and then tell people not to go there. That doesn't work. So people are following the rules. The tables are supposed to be more separated. But, you know, obviously, if you look at the numbers, the Swedish strategy has not worked. And with regard to herd immunity, it's never been Sweden's stated strategy, but it has always been under the breath, so to speak, the bonus of Sweden's strategy. But the numbers that are coming now are not supporting that at all.
Ishan Tharoor from the Washington Post, I want to bring you back into the conversation for a moment, because I think a lot of the argument for keeping things open or reopening things quickly in the United States has been an economic advantage. What do we know about how Sweden's economy has been doing?
It's suffering like everyone else. The Swedish economy is heavily dependent on global value chains. So the fact that the virus has essentially paralyzed global trade in many ways, and Sweden is going to see a hit to its GDP that's roughly, you know, around 6-7%. That's what the recent forecasts suggest. And that's on the same level as Germany and the United States. Mm-hmm. And again, Swedish officials have not framed what they're doing in economic terms, in the way that the lockdowns in the US have been framed in economic terms. Yes, some restaurants remain open, some businesses are functioning, but at the same time, it's taking a big economic hit. The government is trying to mitigate that through its safety nets. And it frames its strategy, which Lena pretty effectively points to as a not particularly successful one, as a kind of long-term plan until a vaccine is found. That this is something that this kind of relaxed structure is something they can live with, as opposed to a lockdown that gets enacted and then people assume that just after it's lifted, everything can go back to normal. In the way they frame it, the Swedish officials you can speak to, they frame it as a kind of new normal that people have to just adjust to.
We have about a minute left, but Lena, from your perspective as a virologist, which countries do you think should be a model for other parts of the world?
Well, I mean, the ones who really implemented harsh or severe restrictions early on, they fared very well, like Israel or Finland, you know, that really started early. Countries like United Kingdom, who did it like halfway through and in a catastrophic manner, for them it was harder, but they are still coming down much more than Sweden is. I would say the United States should not use Sweden as a model. It's not a good model. And the United States is really not faring much better than Sweden. And New York is definitely faring worse. Sweden doesn't have to implement a lockdown at this point. But there are certain things that should be changed. For instance, quarantine of a family where one member is sick, or always using face masks when you work with the elderly. Because there's not even a recommendation of using face masks unless you're working with someone who's sick. So there are simple things that should be changed and so far haven't been changed.
Lena Einhorn is a Swedish virologist and author, and Ishan Tharoor is a foreign affairs columnist at The Washington Post. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Thank you for spending part of your day with us. Please feel free to give us a call and share your thoughts with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can find all of our stories online at thetakeaway.org, and make sure to check out our podcast. I'm Shamita Basu, in for Tanzina Vega. Matt Katz is with you for the rest of this week, and I'll be back on Monday. I'll see you then. Thanks again for listening. This is The Takeaway.